like to welcome you to this session of the Sunstone Symposium entitled Reconciling the Old with the New, Conversion to Mormonism. I'm asked to remind everyone here that admission to this session, like admission to all sessions, is by ticket or name tag only. It says here that there's been an increase in symposium crashers, so we don't want to have anybody here who's not supposed to be here, and if you're not registered, you can do so out in the front hall. This session was originally scheduled to be chaired and or moderated by my mother-in-law, Catherine Fowles. Unfortunately, we have a family conflict today at the symposium. Her mother, Rosemary Fletcher, is a panelist on a Relief Society panel going on at the same time, so she has skipped out on her son-in-law to be with her mother, but we'll forgive her this one time. My father-in-law is here and my wife, so I'm very grateful for that. I would like to briefly introduce each of our panelists, then make a few opening remarks, and then turn the time over to each of them and allow them to introduce themselves and share their stories. I will also be sharing my story a little bit, but since I'm going to be moderating, I'll just kind of throw in a word here and there. When we read the scriptures, we see a lot of historical or scriptural conversions, and I thought of three this morning as I was thinking about what my opening remarks would be. The first we find in the New Testament in Acts chapter 9, and that's, of course, Saul's conversion on the road to Damascus. The other one I thought of was Alma the Younger, found in Mosiah 27 in the Book of Mormon. And the third historical conversion I thought of this morning was Joseph Smith. Now, each of these are pretty serious, dramatic conversions. Angels appeared, people were blinded, and all sorts of really interesting things that I never experienced in my conversion to the church. And our conversion stories today probably will not sound much like the dramatic stories I've just mentioned. As far as I know, none of the panelists here today were visited by angels or had any experiences like that. But I could be wrong. I guess we'll find out in a few minutes. But for each of us, our conversions were every bit as real and every bit as meaningful, I think. We want to share with you our journeys to Mormonism and through Mormonism, our struggles, our surprises, our testimonies, and our disappointments, and perhaps the stories of Trix Dahl, Frank Garish, Jerry Moore, and Chris Williams aren't quite as compelling as Saul's journey on the road to Damascus, but we hope you'll find them interesting, informative, useful, and perhaps in some small measure inspiring. My name is Chris Williams. I joined the church in 1987 at the age of 16. As I said, I will be the moderator and a co-panelist today. To my left is Trix Dahl. If I can find my information sheet here. Trix, I believe, joined the church in the mid-70s at about the age of 30. To her left is Frank Garish. Frank joined the church in 1987, just like I did. He was 24 at the time. He's older than me. And to Frank's left is Jerry Moore, who joined the church, I believe, in 1988 at about the age of 38 years old. So we have a pretty interesting spectrum here as far as ages go. I joined the church basically as a child, and a couple as young adults, and Jerry, I hope you won't be offended if I say you joined the church more in midlife. So without further ado, I would like to turn the time over first, I guess, to Trix. Sure.
I may not... Is this on? Can you hear me? Okay. I may not have been the oldest convert at the time that I was baptized on this panel, but I'm definitely the oldest now. I'm the grandmother of this group, I can tell. I didn't think that would ever happen. I met a friend of mine from the University of Utah, another graduate student that I taught with a few minutes ago, and she was just leaving, and I said, well, you know, I'm participating in this panel on converts. And she said, oh, was there anything unusual about your conversion story? And I said, well... I was a Catholic before. I guess that's as about as outstanding as or unusual as it gets. And she sort of shrugged her shoulders and went on to do whatever it was she wanted to do. So I said, you've heard all this when in those long hours we spent in the office waiting for students to show up. So I was a Catholic. And not only that, but I was a good Catholic. And not only that, but I was a member of a foundational Catholic family in Salt Lake City. I'm a native Salt Laker. My father was a native Salt Laker. My mother, not really. She was born in the Midwest, but her family was from Utah. And I'm one of the most common of all Utah types in that my family was LDS on one side and Catholic on the other. The Catholic side was by far dominant religiously. The LDS side had many difficult experiences with the faith and in life. And with the exception of my grandmother, who died when I was 16, she remained an active LDS member throughout my lifetime, but all of her children had either left the church or simply remained inactive. On the Catholic side, however, were some Irish imports into Utah, and they were very, very Catholic. My grandmother and my mother have been the equivalent of knighted by the Pope. And so they are lady this, so they were lady this and lady that, which is fairly intimidating. And my mother still, to this day, has to be at the cathedral on special occasions in her regalia, with and sit, you know, in a special place because she is a dignitary in the local Catholic diocese. And I was a good Catholic in the sense that I went to church and I believed most everything, and I really, really tried to do my best, although I was not just naturally a religious person who just absolutely loved being part of, you know, who did the voluntary Catholic things. For instance, in college, I went to a Jesuit university. I went to my religion classes, but I did not join the optional religious organizations. I figured that was gilding the lily. I'm sort of the same kind of Mormon, unfortunately. I wish I could say that through my conversion I became much more enthusiastic, but I'm really kind of the same kind of Mormon that I was a Catholic. That is, I feel that I'm committed, I feel that I'm sincere, but I do like moving around in the secular world. My conversion came about because... well, I don't really know why, but these were the circumstances. I married a young Catholic man that I went to school with at Seattle University, which was the Jesuit school where I attended college. We had three children. We were involved in the Vietnam War. He was in the Navy. We moved all over the country. And after a few years, it became too much for me, and the marriage failed, and I returned to Salt Lake with my three children and thought to myself, what do I do now? And I had various answers to that, but unfortunately, they were all interrupted when my uncle insisted on introducing me to a young Latter-day Saint man of his acquaintance. On the occasion of my 28th birthday, I was tired of going as a third or fifth or seventh wheel. And so he lined me up with this young colleague of his, and we went out to dinner and went to see The Godfather. Well, the rest is history. The young man is sitting right here in the front row. his hair has changed color, but otherwise he's exactly the same. And we found that we had certain interests in common and that we got along well together, and we were very interested in each other, and then we attacked the problem of religion. This delayed us for all of 2-3 months, but then we were married. Now, I'm happy to say that he never said to me, I can't marry you unless you adopt my faith. He never said that. All he said to me was, will you have a look at it? Will you go to church with me sometimes? And stuff like that. And this was in between lengthy doctrinal arguments. But I agreed to do that. That was no problem to me because I was in a situation in which my Catholic faith was not sustaining me at the time. When you're faced with a divorce, with remaining single for the rest of your life, because divorce and remarriage cannot be sanctioned by the Catholic Church except under particular circumstances, which it turned out were not too difficult to overcome, but I didn't really want to engage in that. So my Reiner and I were married, and I'll try to make it very, very short. After we were married, I did indeed start going to church with him, as did my children. After a few months, he suggested that maybe the missionaries should come and talk to me, and I agreed to that. And the two missionaries assigned to our area came. Reiner took one look at them, especially the one who didn't especially want to talk to me but wanted to play my guitar the whole time. And he said, "Never mind, elders, goodbye." And so then I had a stake missionary came and just sort of visited with me. And then two more elders were assigned, and these two elders were wonderful, and they passed Reiner's inspection. And so they actually taught me, and somewhat later than they would have liked, I was baptized. For me, joining the LDS Church was part of an ongoing journey, a pilgrimage in my life. I'm aware of having become committed to a Christian lifestyle and to Jesus Christ himself when I was very young as a Catholic. And that part of my life has never changed. From Catholicism to Mormonism has simply been stepping from one path to another that I found easier, an easier access, an easier approach to Christ. Am I out of time yet?
Oh, no, you're doing fine.
Okay. one thing I object to in the LDS faith is that Mormons tend to, when you give them 5 minutes to speak, they tend to speak for 25. And I've really, really worked on not doing that. But over the years, I'm getting worse. I'm getting more like, you know, the born Mormon. And that brings me to the kinds of adjustments that I found necessary as I accepted my new faith. They're almost all cultural because doctrinally, or as one of my professors insists on saying doctrinally, I don't think it makes a whole lot of difference. I mean, the Catholic Church has a systematic theology which they've hammered out over centuries, and any theological question you care to ask, they can answer, however satisfactorily or not. But it doesn't help you when you're divorced and have three small children and don't know what you're going to do with your life. They say nice things to you and, you know, we love you and we'll try to help you, but you're at a dead end. The LDS faith does not have a systematic theology, and you can approach theological doctrinal gaps if you want and argue over them as best you may, but people tend to rally round somebody who is facing a practical chasm, difficulty in their life, such as I was at that time. As far as the cultural adjustments are concerned, I have to say that born Mormons are not terribly good at helping converts make cultural adjustments. And that was the most difficult thing for me. Now, of course, I grew up in Salt Lake, went to Catholic schools, and was taught to thank the Lord on my knees every single day that I was not like these poor, ignorant Mormon natives who didn't know their own religion and didn't know how ridiculous were the things that they believed. And so when I joined this group, I was a little bit nervous, you know, about what these savages were actually like. I mean, I knew the ones that I knew were okay. I remember, my friends laugh at this, but I remember sitting in my house one day on the piano bench and crying and crying and crying at the prospect of being a member of any organization called Relief Society. I mean, that just didn't sound right to me. It was the same after I joined the church when they wanted to call me to a position with the Cub Scouts and I was supposed to go to a powwow. You know, I just, somehow culturally this didn't sit well. And I said to my husband at one time, I said, you know, And this was as an investigator before I joined the church. I said, I'm really worried. I can't give up my Catholic identity, my cultural identity, because it's almost like saying, you know, I'm going to turn into a carrot. You can't do that. And he said, well, don't give it up. Don't give your cultural identity up. And as it's turned out, there are elements of it that I've been able to keep. At the university, I teach humanities, I teach English, I teach intellectual traditions of the West, and I've become something of a medievalist because my knowledge of Catholicism, the Catholic Church, and my childhood exposure to Latin has been a valuable thing that I've been able to keep. As far as my cultural identity is as a Mormon, I have some basis for that because I have this the Mormon side of my family, Mormon grandmother, whose effect on me was always very soothing and introduced quite a different dimension into my life than I experienced as a Catholic. I'm still adjusting to that. It's been 20 years since I've joined the church, but I am adapting to it, although, I mean, sometimes I still want to absolutely scream at people that the word is recommendation, not recommend. You know, and I don't get anywhere with these things. But what is unique about the church and what has been very helpful to me has been the love of members toward individuals coming into the church and their willingness to support new members. This sometimes fails, I know, for new converts, and I would exhort my fellow Latter-day Saints to be very careful about abandoning a new convert. You know, you're baptized, great, goodbye. You know, that I've seen that turn out very, very badly sometimes. But on the other hand, I never have received the love and encouragement from a community before in my life that I've received from the church. And I realize I haven't talked about spiritual experiences, but you can ask about those if you want. I certainly have had them. Thank you.
Chris? Thank you, Trix. You mind if I do that? I'll be brief. This is such an all-encompassing topic to be able to address in 5-10 minutes. I am a convert to the church. I was born and raised in Cranston, Rhode Island. It's funny you mentioned the Godfather. I was raised in a very tight-knit Italian structure of Roman Catholicism. We have very many similarities, and I was trying to note most of the same. That's very interesting, although you're a Salt Laker. I went to Catholic school. I had parochial schooling and was in a preparatory seminary to become a student of divinity and receive holy orders as a Catholic priest. My introduction to the performing arts led me away from that in a great hurry. I decided to become an actor and pursue higher education in theater. My conversion happened sort of as a mixture of the theatrical and the missionary process working together. I was an actor in the company of the Utah Shakespearean Festival the summers of 86 and 87, and while being a graduate student at Penn State University, and you can call this providence if you will, but I was asked to go there 2 summers in a row, and I do believe that that was not a mistake. I do believe that there's been an inspired hand in my life, although not an easy journey, an inspired one nonetheless. The first summer I was there, I was truly in a cultural, I felt like I was in Wonderland. Lewis Carroll was writing my script. I was in Cedar City, Utah, and used to a totally urban existence prior to that. And my first experience with what I perceived to be Mormonism was staying at a hotel just off the strip in Cedar City called the Cedar Crest Motel. And we were roomed 2 together, the actors, and it was during the audition process, a time of high stress there. And I noticed every woman in this community wore the same dress. I didn't understand it. You know, being in Pennsylvania, I thought it was an Amish touch. And there was a surprising lack of male presence in this motel. It seemed like all of the maids, the desk help, everybody, the pool cleaners, all wore the same dress and looked surprisingly Amish. There were Book of Mormons in the lobby of the motel, and I went, aha, this is it. This is the regulated culture of Mormonism. I don't want to be there, don't want to go there, don't want any part of it. Come to find out that it was a fairly large polygamous colony that ran that area of town, even. Sort of like the other side of the proverbial tracks. And that was, I had no idea. I thought polygamy was kind of cool as a conjugal concept, but I mean, it was just ephemeral. I didn't equate it to spirituality whatsoever. So that was my initial exposure to Mormonism. Other than when I was in the seventh grade, someone did invite me to a Christmas party in Cranston, Rhode Island, to the ward there. I didn't know it was a ward. There was no explanation made of faith or doctrine. It was just hang out at this Christmas party. And there were some very strange people there. And we had some food, and they did some very strange, you know, they prayed before the meal. That wasn't too strange. But they had a what they called a program. And everyone sang songs and left. And while being bored with the program, I wandered out into the lobby and noticed pictures on the wall of, I didn't know it was a ward house at the time, of Christ visiting American Indians, or what I perceived to be American Indians in the seventh grade. It was a very incongruous picture for me. What's going on here? There's no scriptural basis for Christ dealing with any kind of Indian or Native North and South American population. I filed that away and called it something that was strange and never investigated it again until I was 24. Some of the fine brethren in Cedar City, they do that to actors that go down there. They just sort of like slip things into conversation. Do you know Christ lives? Little thing over at JB's over a sandwich, you know. Of course, the hard sell never worked with me because I was from an Italian family where the hard sell was par for the course, where you will die, you will go to hell, don't touch, you know, don't do that, don't date, don't, you know. I found my initial experience to the gospel threatening, unfamiliar, uncomfortable, and the people, although well-intentioned, seemed to me ignorant. I have to admit that. They seemed to me just sort of Gomer Pyle-ish. And being a graduate student and having the fountain of all knowledge, I said, I have the answers. Forget it. I don't buy it. Sell your Fuller brushes somewhere else. It was that summer I did meet an individual that would change my life, my future wife. It seems to me the majority of male conversions in this church happen through women. I could be wrong about this. Maybe we need to be in touch with our feminine spiritual side. But for me, it was the relationship with the person that I respected that opened the door to the investigation of the spiritual concepts. And it wasn't only through my girlfriend / fiancé. It was when I started to see people not as threats, but as potential friends and role models. My second season, I returned to the Shakespeare Festival. I got much better casting the second year. There was no attempt to be hard sell with me because I had returned. I was sort of pegged as the guy who didn't buy it. Good. They didn't bother me anymore. My girlfriend, who was from Salt Lake City at the time, got an apartment down there, a form of entrapment, you might say. She wanted to be close. We were still dating at the time, and we were going into dress rehearsals, and they mount all the plays at once. Very stressful time. They mount now at 6 because they have the indoor theater. They mount 6 plays in the same week. Insanity. Everybody is pushed to the limit in terms of patience, and the capacity just to be decent to each other goes away in that dress rehearsal week. And I started suffering from terrible toothaches, which I thought was a manifestation of the stress. I knew it had to be because 2 weeks prior to coming there, I had 1 month left on my mother's Blue Cross coverage because I was turning 24, and they kick you out as a dependent for some reason at that age. And I had a complete dental check, a physical, clean bill of health. Was suffering from terrible toothaches. Went across the street to the festival-recommended dentist, a man named Leslie Burbage. Burbage, great Shakespearean name. So I sat in the chair, and he told me I needed 4 days of root canal. like not one, two, like several on both sides. You know, they put the little swabs in the whole deal. I was not prepared for that. That was the thing that literally sent me over the edge. While working on me, he was a very congenial, large man. We got along very well. He said to me, "I'm not going to give you anesthetic unless you take a pamphlet from the church." True story. That is the hardest sell of all. I am in no position to deny this reception. I take the pamphlet. And then he backed off. And I developed a friendship until he died in a car accident 3 years ago here in Salt Lake. I developed a very strong friendship and a mentorship. My father passed away when I was six, so there's a real strong bond there. But it was his love for me just as a person, just as somebody who walked into the office, that encouraged me to investigate. And so the common theme, at least in my conversion, I believe, is people were cool people, they were considerate people, and they loved themselves and what they were talking about, not, "This is good for you, let me preach to you." Took the discussions. A pair of elders came to my apartment in the College Avenue Apartments in Cedar City. My future wife said, "I will do anything, elders, if you will give him the discussions." They asked for a complete Thanksgiving meal. Turkey, the whole deal. She did that. She went to the little mini Albertsons they had there and got all of the stuff and made a complete Thanksgiving meal. Our dinner conversation consisted of wanting to hear my rock and roll tapes, wanting to play my guitar. Very interesting that you would say that. Maybe it's a common thing with missionaries. I don't know. A couple of Old Testament jokes about Moses, and no gospel discussion whatsoever. My future wife was devastated. As soon as they left, she immediately called the stake president. Now, she wasn't even a member, you know, she's a member up here in Salt Lake. She found out who the stake president was and railed on him for 15 minutes and said, "I don't know what kind of ship you're running down here, but you need to take care of this." Come to find out, the dentist who was administering to me was the stake mission president. And he came with the heavy artillery back to my apartment himself and said, "I understand you're investigating the gospel. Let's sit down." And that was the beginning of all of the discussions. I was not baptized in Cedar City. I didn't believe it could be true outside of Utah. I said, "There's something in the air. It's beautiful scenery, purple mountains, majesty, fruited plains, the whole deal, you know, Cedar Break, Zion. This is an unnatural environment. It's the most natural of all, but it felt unnatural to me because it didn't have dirt in the streets, you know. I had to go back. I had to go back home to my dysfunctional past to make sure that this was true. I arrived at graduate school a week late. Two missionaries were waiting for me at my door before I even got into my doorway with my luggage off of the plane. To make sure it wasn't a fluke again, I took all of the discussions again from two sets of elders. I was a graduate assistant at the time teaching classes, invited them on their P-Day to my acting classes. I remember they were sitting in a circle one day, and we were all introducing, and I said, "These are two friends of mine from the West." And they were wearing regular clothing. And I asked them to introduce themselves, and they said, the first one said, "My name is Elder, my name," he couldn't remember his first name. They really thought people from the West were strange in Pennsylvania. I subsequently was baptized on the session of General Conference, between sessions of General Conference, sorry, in October of 1987, and later that year was married. I have three children now, two twin girls and a five-year-old boy. My decision to come here was one of necessity. My wife had a Utah teacher certificate. I was an actor. Need I say more? We go where the money is. I had a master's degree in hand and no prospects. Came to Salt Lake and immediately started to work and flourish. I do not think that's an accident. There's a direct correlation between my spiritual strength and my career strength. And when I lapse spiritually, I go into the toilet professionally. I've never felt a more strong connection to that. And it's not because I'm in, you know, near the breast of the Mother Church. I don't think that has anything to do with it. I think I'm committed to forging a life and roots away from Don Corleone's homeland, you know, away from the uncomfortability of a life that wasn't so good to me. Was I looking for a placebo in Mormonism? Maybe. But it hasn't been one since I've been practicing. This is difficult for me to talk about because I'm not acting. This is me. I'm not playing Falstaff. You know, this is the real deal. I have a strong testimony that I did the right thing, that I was led by a divine hand, and my subsequent baptism was not a mistake. And my choices overall in major watershed experiences have been divinely inspired. Doesn't mean I'm up. I live up to the billing. I'm certainly imperfect, but I believe there's a pattern to my life, and I have no idea what's going to happen. There's a reason why I get 15 W-2s at the end of the year, and then I'm not settled. I haven't found where I'm going yet. I'm an adjunct professor at the U. Again, adjunct is temporary. Everything in my life is temporary. I don't know. I don't think I'll be a GA. I don't think that's going to happen. I can't stomach the suits. Well, you know, maybe if I can wear this. But I want you to know that I do believe the church is true. And I was led to it, and I discovered it not by mistake. And I gave it a lot of ponderance and a lot of study, and the intellect did not conflict with the spiritual information. My investigation, it wasn't like I'm too smart to believe this is true. None of that stuff. And as a former Catholic and a former studied Catholic in terms of doctrine, it made perfect sense to me that this church was the absolute fulfillment of Catholic theology. It was sort of like the bridge was out for me. And I came to the edge and went, do I take a leap of faith or another structure I can go on? And Mormonism completed the bridge for me, doctrinally. The temporal workings, as we all know, are imperfect. We've got to look past that, as far as I'm concerned. And I've had experiences that have been uncomfortable and potentially faith-shattering, but it hasn't yet. I've had wonderful bishops. I've had 4 bishops in my life, one of them sitting right here. It's worked for me. And I'd like to entertain questions after we're all done. Thank you.
Well, my name is Jerry Moore, and as I told you, I converted the church when I was 38 years old. I grew up in Southern California, not of any faith. Every summer I was sent to Bible school at a local Baptist church, and I just remember all the stories about Goliath and all the spectacular stories that you read in the Old Testament. I moved to Utah in 1980, and I was I worked for Kawasaki Motorcycles as a district manager and traveled Utah, Idaho, and parts of Nevada. And in several of my dealerships, I had several members of the LDS Church, and I had several Books of Mormon given to me, which I put in the trunk, and that's where they stayed. But as I lived in Utah, my first neighbor when I moved into Sandy was a member of the church and made a very big impression upon me. He was always there to help me no matter what I was doing. He befriended me, which was totally different from the person who preceded me about his experiences in Utah. He hated it. He said their laws were screwy. You couldn't get a drink if you went to a restaurant. Everything negative that he could say, he absolutely railed upon. When I moved here, I found it completely the opposite. I found the people to be friendly and helpful. My journey to my conversion also started with a young woman. I met her if she was here, she'd be very upset with me, but I met her in a I'd say bar, but it was called the Pub. Everybody's familiar with that in Raleigh Square. She had a friend that worked there. I had a friend that worked there. her reason was there to visit. My reason was there to imbibe in their what they dispensed from behind the bar. We met through a fluke. We went on a date, and I started dating her in 1986. She was a teacher at the time. I met her family, and being in Utah by myself, it was probably something that I needed the most, is I needed a connection. And her family brought me in as a member of her family, and her family was a mix of members and non-members. Her mother was a member. Her father grew up a non-member. But I always referred to my father-in-law as probably the most, at the time, the most LDS, non-LDS person I had ever met. He lived the way I thought every member of the church should live. His children were raised that way, and they were a great influence on me. My Sundays consisted of waking up every morning at 7 and going to Westminster College and playing basketball until noon. That was, to me, that was how I spent my Sundays. And my asked me to attend church, and I said, no, that's fine. I'm just fine the way I am. I play basketball on Sundays, and that's the way I relate to, you know, God. I just figure that's what I do, and I do best. And as we were dating, and I got more involved with her family and friends in the ward that I was living in, I got involved playing basketball with the ward basketball team. She saw to it they called me up and invited me to play ward ball. And I got more friends that way, and they were very subtle. They never cajoled. They never just tried to drag me into church. They just talked to me. They befriended me again. And one Sunday, unbeknownst to my girlfriend, I happened to enter her ward, which is the Yale Second Ward. I sat back in a corner of the ward and all by myself. And I remember that a feeling came over me that this was where I was to be. I don't know what it was. I just felt, and I guess it was a spirit coming to me, that was where I was to be. My life up to that time was very up and down. I was on a path that was not leading anywhere, and I believe that there was a reason that I happened to meet my wife in a bar. Why she would be there, who knows? I know why I was there, but I didn't know why she was there. But as I sat there and that feeling came over me, at the time the bishop happened to be sitting up in the podium, up on the front, and he looked right at me and smiled at me, and I happened to look back at him and smile, and I guess that was the day that I was kind of hooked. It was not anyone per se talking me into it or giving me lessons. It's just that I believe that the Spirit came to me and told me that that was where I should be. Now, I did not join the church immediately. It took 2.5 years to actually join the church. Before I was a member, I was a scout leader in my home ward. I coached the young men's basketball teams as a non-member, but as someone that attended church on a regular basis. When I had my lessons, I had elders, but I also had a bishop and an ex-bishop teaching us. And when I say us, it was my father-in-law and I took the lessons at the same time. And it was a rather interesting lesson sessions, because my father-in-law probably gave most of the lessons. As they went through the flip charts, he would tell the elders what he felt at the time that he painted some of these pictures that they were showing to other people. My father-in-law is Dale Kilborn, and he has painted probably thousands of pictures and paintings and things for the church. You go to Nauvoo and you find many of the murals that are there were painted by him. one of the most interesting stories that he had told me and the elders was he had the opportunity to hold Joseph Smith's death mask. And he said it was a little different because at the time the death mask was made that he used to make the painting, he had passed on for a few days and his face had kind of drooped a little bit. Well, he painted the painting, and the next morning the face was gone. The paint had run completely off. And he said then he felt as if someone was over his shoulder as he painted it. And he today, to this day, he feels that it is the likeness that he believes is most, that is Joseph Smith. And as I sat and listened to this man, who was not a member, but told of the instances and the experiences that he had while he did his artwork for the church, I grew closer and closer to him as a friend and as a future father-in-law, but also to the bishop at that time and the neighbor that also taught us. Again, it was still a little time after the lessons, but I was baptized the day before my wife and I were married. So it was a rather hectic weekend. We were married in August of 1988. I was baptized August 12th. Since that time, I can just tell you that I've had many ups and downs. It is a struggle for me. It all goes back to my upbringing. Not necessarily my upbringing, but just the way I had lived my life. It is hard to stay on that road and hold on to the rod that is before us. I struggle, maybe not on a daily basis, but that struggle is always there. And when I do let go of that rod, I do suffer, both spiritually and personally, in every manner that I can think of. My wife is probably the light that keeps me on that path, because she is such a spiritual, strong person. I have always been weak to the ways of the world. We are to be, as they say, we are to be in the world but not of it, and I struggle with that. This church has shown me a way to stay off the gray area, the gray areas that can be very enticing. My wife and I have a young daughter. My daughter was born when I was 42, and I thought I would never have any other children. And that is probably one of the largest blessings in my life. Her spirit is one of purity and of light, and it just amazes me that at 42 that I can look at her and know that I've made some right decisions in my life. Frank and I had been in the same ward for many years, and we were kind of ships in the night that collided and have stuck together. I was lucky enough to be not kind of a part of Chris's baptism, because he was on the basketball team that I coached in that ward and helped coach. And his coach and I, Chris Fuller and I, were very impressed with Chris. And I know Chris Fuller remains a big part of Chris Williams' life. And I was also able to baptize my son in the church when he was 18. He has since become inactive, but I still see in him some of the things that he struggles with in me. And I have faith that he will come back to the church and be able to live a life that I think he will be most happy with. I don't have a whole lot to say. It's just that it was kind of a lightning bolt. I never thought that that would happen to me. But I can tell you from that feeling of that one Sunday of knowing that this is where I should be, and I sometimes forget that, but when I do remember that, that my faith strengthens my family, relationships with my family and everyone else strengthens. That's all I have to say.
Well, I am the moderator today, but I'm also a panelist, and I think I should introduce myself a little bit, too. I should start with my family. I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and my parents divorced at a very young age. I was only about three when they were divorced. And my mother remarried, and we moved to Salt Lake City. My stepdad was a geologist, and Utah is a good place for geology, and he got a job here. And we moved here when I was about five or six. My family has a very diverse religious background. In fact, I need notes in order to tell you about it because it's hard to keep straight. My mom and my stepdad were both raised in Wisconsin Lutherans, but they became disenchanted with religion. They were children of the 60s, and once they came of age and went off to college, they left church behind. My father was raised, my mom and my stepdad are now Unitarians. I think somewhere along the line, when I became 10 years old and I had a little sister, they felt like they needed a church, but they didn't want the church they had, and they wanted a church they could be flexible with, so they chose to be Unitarians, and they're really quite committed Unitarians. My mom teaches Sunday school. It seems a little strange, having known Unitarians as long as I have, to say that there's a committed Unitarian. And I don't mean that as a shot against Unitarians. I think most would agree. But they really are quite committed. And they're committed being not committed to anything, and that's worked for them. My dad was raised a Catholic, but today he's no longer a practicing Catholic. I would have said 5 months ago that my dad's an atheist, but we had an experience in my family just a couple months ago. My grandmother died, his mother, and I saw a side of my dad that I didn't know existed, and I guess the best description to put on my dad would be to call him an agnostic. My stepmother, his wife, is the youngest daughter of a Lutheran minister, and she remains committed to her faith today. It was a real challenge for her when she married, because she was not only marrying a Catholic, but she was marrying a lapsed Catholic, and her parents were a little concerned about that. Not nearly as concerned as when I decided to be a Mormon, but that's another story. This diversity of religious background extends beyond just my immediate family. My grandparents, my dad's parents, were Catholic. My grandfather still is a committed Catholic, but he was raised an Episcopalian, and was an Episcopalian when my grandparents were married, and was an Episcopalian for the first 10 years of their marriage, and then one day, kind of out of the blue, according to my grandmother, decided that he wanted to be a Catholic and wanted his family to be unified in their faith. So he became a Catholic and is one of the most committed Catholics I know, and very, very faithful, not just to his church, but to God, and a very understanding of the commitments of others. My mother's brother, he's an evangelical born-again Christian, and when I joined the church, I got an envelope about that thick of material from him telling me all the things about the Mormon church that I should know that they probably weren't telling me. A short time after I started investigating in the church, I also received two books from my well-intentioned stepmother. One was called The God Makers. And I received all this material shortly after I had been through the missionary discussions, and I was only 16, or actually I was only 15 at the time, and I'd pretty much decided that I wanted to join the church. I had been exposed to Mormons really all my life. We moved here when I was very young, and all my friends had always been Mormon. I never had much religious training from my parents, even when they started going to the Unitarian Church here in Salt Lake City. They left it up to me. I didn't have to go with them if I didn't want to, and I usually didn't. So I encountered this anti-Mormon material shortly after I had decided that I wanted to be a Mormon, and it gave me pause. I wasn't so sure I was doing the right thing. But in the end, it turned out to be a blessing, because my mother told me, well, you're not going to get baptized at the age of 15. You're not going to run off and be a Mormon at the age of 15. You have to wait until you're 16. And the reason she decided I had to wait until I was 16, I guess, is if you're old enough to drive a car, I guess you're old enough to drive your spiritual life. Also, at the Unitarian Church in Salt Lake City, 16 is the age where you make more of a formal commitment to the congregation. And so she decided that was when I was going to decide. So that gave me a whole summer, really, to read The God Makers. And to look at all these that I received from my uncle. And I learned a lot about Mormonism at a very early age, and I learned a lot of things that I probably wasn't ready to learn and probably really didn't want to learn. But in the end, I was stronger for it. And despite the obstacles that were placed before me, I still felt like it was the right thing to do. And looking back, I mean, I'm still young. I'm only 23 years old. But looking back at myself when I was 15, I kind of think, what the hell was I thinking? What motivated me? Was it because I wanted to be like my friends, or was there something else? And looking back, I don't know that I can really articulate what my motivation was, but something kept me going, and I joined the church in November of 1987. Actually, as it turns out, just a few days after Frank joined the church. The things that brought me to the church were really my friends. I had a lot of really close friends who were Mormon, and they were really accepting of me as a non-Mormon. At least that was my perception at the time, is that they accepted me. But, you know, they were still also perfectly willing to try to convert me and to send the missionaries to me. And in the end, it worked out. It's been an interesting journey with my very diverse family background. It's always very interesting to put this in perspective with my family and my upbringing, and try to understand where I fit now in my family. And it's really been a blessing for all of us. My parents have become more accepting of Mormons, much more accepting than they were before I joined the church. They were outsiders in Utah, and they felt it, and they resented it, I think, quite a bit. And it became much more difficult for them to hurt an institution when their son was a part of that institution, and when they could see that I was committed to it. So there's been a softening effect in my family, not just towards Mormons, but I think towards people of different faith and different backgrounds in general. That's really about all I'm going to say about me. If you have more questions when we come to the question and answer time, you're certainly welcome to ask. But I think now we'll move on to the question and answers from the moderator. I put together a list of questions. I'm sorry, there wasn't much of a segue there, but Trix answered quite a few of them, but since I gave her a list, I have come up with some others. I talked with Brian Cagle at Sunstone, and I said, you know, I need some questions from someone who's been a Mormon all his life. I need to know what kind of questions Mormons will want to ask us, because I couldn't do that because I haven't been a Mormon all my life. And he gave me some questions, and some of them may be things that you're thinking of, and some of them may not be. So when I'm done with my questions, and when we get done talking about some of the things I'm going to bring up here, we're going to turn the time over to you. I would imagine there are probably several converts in the audience here, but there may be some who have been members of their life who also want to ask questions, but we invite all of you to do so. The first question I have for this panel is what role did the Book of Mormon play in your conversion? The church put such an emphasis on the importance of the Book of Mormon in missionary work, and I served a mission. I went to Czechoslovakia, and we had a real dearth of materials in the proper languages, and one of the things we had missing for some time on my mission was the Book of Mormon, and I found that made missionary work challenging, but I don't know if that was my warped missionary mind understanding that, or if there was something more to that. So I would just like to know how the Book of Mormon affected all of you.
The Book of Mormon, I dutifully read it in the process of my conversion. It wasn't terrifically helpful to me. I found other things more helpful, and the Book of Mormon has been something that I've had to grow with over the years. But I would have to say the challenge of the Book of Mormon, of approaching it and trying to comprehend it, was a positive thing for me. But I didn't receive any immediate illumination or confirmation of that particularly.
I'll agree somewhat that the Book of Mormon, the concept of the Book of Mormon fascinated me as an investigator, that there could be other scriptures extant, or there could be other divine revelation that had not been uncovered, at least to me yet. And so I dug into it with voracious appetite, but kind of got stuck in the history a bit. And I remember reading, I was challenged by the both sets of missionaries to read, and I would relegate to the italics chapter to chapter, you know, I didn't go all the way through. But the scriptures that I was challenged to read, I did, particularly the one, ask of yourself if these things be true. And that was a very inspirational scripture for me. The Book of Mormon and I, just like the relationships in my life, have to develop and mature together. I knew the New Testament pretty well. And, yeah, as you did. And I find that the Book of Mormon enlightens what I know from Old and New Testament scripture, enlightens what I know, and also tells me what I don't know about my own spirituality. It consistently challenges me by records of lives and events. But initially, it was very pithy, and it's sort of like I just wanted to get to it, and here I was stalled. It sort of stopped me. And that sounds like a terrible thing to say about the Book of Mormon. It's a wonderfully inspired book. But it wasn't what I needed at the time.
Yeah. I too, it didn't have very much influence on me. I read books from some friends on Joseph Smith, several books about his life and how he came upon his starting of Mormon, of the LDS Church, and I think that influenced me more than the Book of Mormon did. But as I read it and study more of it, it does make a larger impact on my life and adds to what I knew of the New Testament and the Old Testament.
I'll answer this question too. I would say I would agree that initially the Book of Mormon was very difficult for me. And I think it might have been that I was a teenager and didn't want to read something written like that. The language was very, very unusual for me, and it was something that I had difficulty with. And really, the Book of Mormon didn't become important to my faith, I think, until my mission, until I was teaching the Book of Mormon and felt like I had to know the Book of Mormon. And that's when the Book of Mormon became important to me. I wonder if maybe there's something we should be telling the church missionary committees here about the Book of Mormon, but they probably wouldn't listen.
You know the comic books? I got the DNC in comic book form, Book of Mormon, and that was kind of fun, you know, to see things kind of in color and stuff.
Thanks, Frank. Let's see, the next question I have here. Trick's pretty much answered this, but for Frank and for Jerry, what was it about Mormonism aside from women that made it attractive to you? I mean, was there any one thing about the church, or were there a couple of things about the church that were attractive to you before you joined the church, other than your significant others?
Well, I think first impressions. Like I said, when I moved here, the gentleman that preceded me in the position that I had with the company I worked for absolutely hated it. He didn't particularly care for the Mormons, where when I came, I had a completely different experience. I just had very helpful neighbors, people that were always thoughtful and kind, and to me, watching them with their children, I had two children from a previous marriage that weren't living with me, and I think that probably ate at me the most, is watching them with their children every day, how they related families, and then being brought into my wife's family so readily and so easily. I think that it said a lot to me about some of the beliefs and some of the direction that the church has, more family than anything.
I'll echo that. The personal lives, the testimony of how they live their lives, not even gospel related, they were just decent people. And culturally, that was a foreign item to me. I know that sounds strange, but I really wasn't surrounded by decent, overall decent people. And that, so it was foreign and appealing. And the other thing was the purity of the message that I received. It wasn't mystified, it wasn't packaged, it was just pure. Dare I say the word truth? That can be dangerous. You know, it's like drinking Everclear. There's too much proof there. Did I say that? If the purity isn't able to be consumed, it can do damage to somebody who isn't ready to hear it. So there needs to be a preparation. There needs to be a softening of the heart. and of the intellect, and you got to let things go to receive the message. But I would say the testimony of how people live their lives and the purity of the message.
Yeah. Thanks. The next question may seem like kind of a strange one, so I'm going to preface it a little bit, give you a little background. Last night, my wife and I were having a conversation about God. We were talking about what God is, who he is, and how we understand him. And I found that my understanding of God probably isn't really very classical Mormon. And it may still be evolving, and I may still eventually get to that very Mormon understanding of God. And I was wondering if, for any of you, there was something like that. Was there something about your understanding of God or some other spiritual concept, some other doctrinal concept that the church offered that didn't quite mesh with your previous understanding or with your upbringing or something along those lines? For me, it was, and it still is, the mystery of God. God has always been very mysterious for me, and I like that. I like that Mormonism defines who and what God is very clearly. That gives me comfort. But there's a concept of God that is still very mysterious to me, and I'm still not sure I've been able to reconcile the two. And I was wondering if there was anything like that for any of our panelists.
I had heard during my growing up years the LDS doctrine of God as a being with a body. I had heard that criticized and insulted, really. But it hadn't. I don't recall that it had any effect on me, and so that perceptual shift was not difficult for me. I think that people in the church, lifelong members, tend to perceive converts as not having access through their former faith to a personal God, and that was not my experience. God was not just Christ, but God the Father was a personal God to me, and although that perception has become clearer as I've learned and grown through my new faith, it didn't change essentially.
I think my initial concept of God as a growing up Catholic was the God of the Old Testament. The always, for some reason, fiery. The Ten Commandments is the one that keeps hitting me. You know, the big thing, zap, and there goes the ten, you know. And it's, oh, that's Cecil B. DeMille. but those images are very strong with me, particularly in parochial schooling, the element of fear and retribution as the primary attributes of God. God is a God of vengeance. And when I started studying the gospel to learn that the Jehovah of the Old Testament was Christ, puts a whole new spin on it for me. My spin on it now, I think, is God very much is a compassionate person, deity, that understands me rather than is pointing a finger at me. That could be my parenting. Maybe as an adult I'm starting to see it's not a blame issue, and it's more of, now that I'm a parent, I think I understand God more, perhaps personally, as the longer I become a parent. And I want a dialogue with my children, and I get frustrated sometimes, and that might be the God of the Old Testament, the frustrated, you know, don't touch that, that's hot. But the thing I'm trying to and striving for desperately is to maintain a personal relationship with the concept of deity and with Christ and with Heavenly Father. And that is weird because my entire upbringing is to say that God is mysterious. It's a Holy Trinity not meant to be explained until after I die. And now I'm told, wow, you know, there's a direct path and it's accessible. And there's comfort in that, and yet so much to live up to that it's daunting.
Well, having grown up not in any particular faith, my mother, although she was also raised as a Baptist, had always let us know that it was important to pray to God and to Jesus Christ. And I remember even before I joined the church, if I didn't necessarily pray, but I would have conversations with Christ by myself, driving in the car along the flatlands up in Idaho. My concept, I've always thought it was someone, something to talk to when you had a problem, someone or something to go to. And it still is that, and that's who I go to now when I do have problems. Probably not enough. I probably still rely too much on myself than allowing him to help me even more. But I don't know if my concept changes, because I've always had that personal relationship. I felt had a personal relationship, because not necessarily through prayer, but through conversations, talking about myself and about my life with Christ.
Frank's the timekeeper. He's reminding me where we are. Let's see. There was another question here I wanted to ask. Oh, yes. This is from Brian Cagle. When I talked to him and to get some suggestions, was there anything you wish the missionaries would have told you? Are there any surprises?
I had read so much before I finally had the discussions that... I taught the missionaries a thing or two, or so they said. We discussed everything that I needed to discuss at that time.
I think, going back to your initial comments, I wasn't prepared for the culture shock of the three meeting setup. I was, in general, my experience with church, and I sort of became inactive as a Catholic, but was the community of the church was this ubiquitous thing that you came and took the sacrament and left, and there wasn't a socialization to the religion. There wasn't home teaching, really. I mean, we used to go to the priest to have our car blessed when we that's about it. And now I was sort of in this Skinner box, this confined environment, with other members, and I was forced to be, convivial. I was forced to go to Sunday school. I don't want to say forced. It was part of the deal. You go to Sunday school, you go to Elders Quorum, you take your calling, and there's a lot more to this than just, I do believe I have a testimony. Now you've got to be temporal and active about it. Catholics can sit back and be acted upon, and in my opinion, and then now I have to do stuff. How do I do it? I remember the first time I, as a member of the Aaronic priesthood, I was a prospective elder, carried the tray for the sacrament, and I looked around and I tried to copy, these 12-year-olds. I remember, hunching over and acting kind of self-conscious, because I thought that was the ritual. So it's taken me a few years to understand that there is individual expression within how you do what you do, and I'm still not prepared for being able, for dealing with the cultural differences and as they relate to doctrine.
I can't really think of anything that I think they should that I would like them to tell me. I mean, before I had the lessons, I was attending church on a regular basis, so I had an idea of what to expect. So not really anything in particular, no.
I want to add just one thing, though. I do have something to say on this, that I was, we had a teenage, fairly recent convert living with us a couple of years ago, and one day he said to me, does the church have any thoughts on abortion? And I said, why, yes. we don't go for that, And he said, oh dear, I didn't realize that. And I thought, where were the missionaries? And so I asked some of my nephews who'd recently been on missions why, in Europe where this young man was converted, why they hadn't said anything about that. And he said, well, we only do the basic stuff. You find out about all that later. And I thought, this could be difficult. And I don't know if it is ever difficult. But I think that certain very strict prescriptions ought to be mentioned. I just think that there's a shock potential that needs to be addressed somewhere along the line.
And there's an axiom in teaching, don't offer a student what he's beyond the capacity to understand. So in other words, you build a bridge. However, there also is the mentality, don't give them all of the information because they may run away. So, I mean, if someone came to me initially with the concept that I would be a god, that may have alienated me. And there are some concepts, doctrinally and socially in the church that need to be understood and matured with. It's not the Catholic thing of you'll understand that later, but I think that you grow a deepening appreciation for the gospel and all, in its entirety, but you do need to walk before you can run.
Yeah, I think for me, there wasn't really anything that I wish they would have told me, because, I mean, I had the God Makers right in front of me. I mean, it was pretty well laid out, and things like the temple and all sorts of things that a lot of, I think, new converts are confronted with. I was confronted with before I joined the church in a rather aggressive way, and I had to find solutions to those concerns pretty quickly. My experience as a missionary tends me to believe that maybe there are four exceptions up here, that there are a lot of new converts who are surprised by certain concepts, maybe that they could become gods, or that there's a prohibition on things like abortion. But even like more basic things like the temple, I think sometimes what the purpose of the temple is and what goes on inside temples, I think those things can be very surprising and sometimes almost faith-shattering to new converts. But that was my experience as a missionary, not as a investigator. See, I have one more question, and then we'll let the audience members have at us. What kind of difficulties did you encounter with family or friends when you decided to join the church, if any? I alluded a little bit earlier to, well, I mean, you know, I got all this stuff in the mail from family members, but my own parents, although they were reluctant to see me join the church, they were really quite supportive. As long as I waited until that age 16, that magical age, they were okay, and they were really pretty supportive. They weren't always very understanding, but they were pretty supportive. And my friends, of course, they were jumping with joy.
This is a question I'm often asked because of my parents, my family's continued commitment to Catholicism and their standing in the community as Catholics and so forth and so on. But it's really kind of interesting because my family are committed to principles, okay, and we don't always stick with them, but we try. And one of them is that when an adult makes a decision in the family that is not obviously a product of insanity, you support them on it. And so they did that. My father died when I was a senior in high school, so he was not around. I don't know what he would have said. But my mother and my sister, who were left, were, in a sense, relieved that I had some place to go with my life because, you know, I had been in numerous difficulties with it. And there have been rough moments. Occasionally, I think that Reiner and I appear at certain gatherings as token Mormons, you know, because somebody in the family will point at us and say, well, we're very open-minded. Here we have this Latter-day Saint couple in our family, and Reiner and I sort of look at each other. But I know that, see, my mother was born nominally LDS and is a convert to Catholicism, and her LDS mother was very respectful of her decision to join that faith and was very protective of her, that when fellow Latter-day Saints wanted to go after my mother and remind her that she was on the wrong path, my grandmother wouldn't tolerate that. And so my mother has more or less done the same thing for me, in that when Catholic extended family members have, I think, wanted to say something to me, I think she's told them to can it. I think so.
Unlike you, my mother breeds contention. For my self-preservation, I didn't tell my mother I was baptized until I came home for Christmas. I was baptized in October. I didn't make any mention of it to her. I thought Christmas was an appropriate time to bring it up, maybe. Our relationship has been changed forever because of that fact that I have sort of sold out. This is a woman who has, you know, candles around St. Anthony next to her bed, and the novena stuff. And even though she doesn't go to Mass, she'll still pray to St. Anthony. My extended family are supportive of me. I have the wonderful buffer of geography. if we were in the same town, I think there would be some major issues to be confronted, and we probably wouldn't be speaking. And that's unfortunate. And I haven't come to deal, you know, I mean, we send cards and letters and, you know, my children, we correspond. But my relationship, and this is kind of sad, has been forever changed with my family members. And I don't think it's a Catholic versus Mormon issue. It's the fact that I am different now, sociologically. And my wife, according to my mother, shoulders a lot of that blame. And so their relationship is completely, you know, non-existent pretty much. It's a tough thing to deal with. I do believe my place in the cosmos is ultimately more important than what my mother thinks of me. But there's a loss there.
I didn't have any problems with that. My family all living in California, so my decision was basically my own. Friend-wise, though, I think I put more emphasis on the fact that I was becoming a Mormon and worried more about what they thought than they actually thought. And once they learned the fact that I was converting to Mormonism, they were very supportive, even though they were non-Mormon.
We have 15 minutes left for questions. We want to get all the questions on the tape, so if you have a question, please come up and ask us.
I was very impressed with the extent to which your conversions were involved in a social context. And I understand a few years ago, the Brethren commissioned a survey of new converts and to find out why people joined the church. And they were very disappointed in the results because most people said, we like the people we found there. They expected, apparently, the sort of a, I found the truth. And as I look, I see a major shift here. The journals I've read, 2 or 3 dozen conversions accounts, in each case, there was almost a seeking for the truth about the nature of God, the true way to baptize, confusion over infant baptism, any number of doctrinal or doctrinal ideas. And I wonder, was there anything that suddenly you said, wow, yeah, this is true? Or did the social context just sweep you up? I'm not saying that's unimportant, but was there a conversion to capital T truth? And what was it?
I know I'm going to sound like a postmodern critic, which is what, you know, my part of my training is, but I think the Brethren may be victims of old-style humanism if they think that there is truth, with a capital T, floating around as a disembodied essence. I mean, they get that from Plato. They don't get that from the scriptures. I'm sorry, I shouldn't be saying this, I know. But the truth is not a disembodied essence. You have to find it in, you know, while we're here on this material plane, you find the truth in specifics and in concrete things, in people, in situations, and it's there. It's there. There's no question about it. But it is not floating around somewhere up there so that you can somehow perceive it without specific details and specific happenings. I could tell you my conversion on the basis of that if I wanted to shape it that way. I had questions about, specifically I remember as a six-year-old, in Catholic boarding school, rejecting the doctrine of the afterlife as they presented it to me, which sounds really silly, but that's the way I remember it. And the doctrine of eternal progression settled right into the void that had been there since I was 6 years old. So that did happen, but it didn't happen without Reiner and myself sitting there discussing it, you know, and the relationship that we had.
I might have had more of a Saul-like conversion than you. Maybe my receptors were right or something. I do ascribe to the educational philosophy that students do know everything they're being taught. They just need to discover it. It comes from the Latin educ, isn't it? To lead out or to lead forth education.
It also comes from Plato.
Oh, from Plato's Cave?
Yeah, you're remembering things. You're not learning them.
Right. So in other words, we all have this information in our hard drive, and we just need to click the right application and pull it up. When I knelt down and prayed with the missionaries, I had the burning bosom. I don't want to feel ashamed about that, but I had a manifestation of a purer truth than I had been yet privy to. If that came from inside of me, probably did. I don't think it's emotional contagion, though. I don't think it's just something that happened by mistake. I do believe there was a divine manifestation. The social stuff sort of happened to me later. My conversion was a fairly solitary experience in terms of my relationship with the gospel and my future wives. But, I mean, basically it was me. And I wasn't cajoled with basketball. And I wasn't surrounded. You know, I sort of held everybody at an arm's distance before. And then I accepted. When I accepted that as truth, then I said, okay, I'll play basketball. I'll set up chairs. I'll do whatever it is it takes. But I had to find out the pure truth first.
I just played basketball to play basketball. It didn't matter one way or another. But what my time came when I sat in the corner of that chapel, and I knew that was where I was to be. The social part was nice, and I liked the way they treated me, but I think if I hadn't had that feeling, it wouldn't have mattered. I'd have just played basketball on Saturday mornings or Wednesday nights and kept going to basketball on Sunday mornings. But without that feeling, I don't think I would be here today, but I believe that feeling of what I consider the spirit entering me at that time, telling me this is where I should be, that was the deciding factor for me. Although I believe that, you know, we are asked to be Christ-like, and I believe that's where a lot of the truth comes, and I believe the conversion does come a lot from the people that you associate with. The love that is given honestly and fully will do more than having read a book, because that truth comes from within and not from, I believe the words that they read in turn comes out from within them. And I think that's where the truth comes from.
I learned a little maxim on my mission that God helps each of us through other people. And I think that's how I understand my conversion. I was led to something that to me is very important, that for me is truth, and that for me has a very special place. But I was led to it through other people. And I think sometimes I've looked back at my own conversion and wondered, gosh, you know, I was a teenager. Was I cajoled into this, like Frank said, with basketball, or was there something that was I deceived? Was I taken advantage of? And I don't think I was. I think I was truly guided by God through other people to find my place spiritually. Come on up.
I can remember when I was going through the conversion process, I was an adult as well, and I guess this is mostly for Trix, because the rest of you were baptized after 1978, but the hardest thing for me was the blacks not holding the priesthood, and that was the major stumbling block for about 8 months before I was able to get over it, and I didn't get over it until Spencer W. Kimball sent me a personal letter regarding his thoughts on the case. And so I wondered, for Trix, how she reconciled that, and for the others of you, would something like that have been a problem for your conversion?
Reiner will tell you it was a terrible problem for me. It was one of the things that we argued over the hardest, and he did not adopt a doctrinal position in answer to my questions about that. But the way I reconciled it was this, and I wasn't privileged to get a personal letter from President Kimball. It would have certainly helped if it had, but I never thought of that. But I was a great reader of conversion stories and other people's opinions on this thing, and I knew that there were black members of the LDS Church, and ultimately I read some of their accounts, and I finally, and see, since I was baptized in 1974, I had 4 years until this issue became clear for me, but I decided simply if it was good, if it was okay for them, it was okay for me, you know, if there had been no black members of the church, I probably would not have been able to manage at that time.
That's a very large question. When I heard about that, I didn't know it was just limited to black members of the church. Isn't it all worthy males? It's not specifically a black amendment, is it? Or revelation, sorry.
That's what it amounted to.
Yeah. So that was de facto, it was a black issue?
No other worthy males.
So, I mean, so the Maoris were there before and all of the other, the Pacific Islanders and the, well, No, I'm leaving. Thank you. I don't know how to deal with that. It leads me to larger questions about celestial glory, and if you can't go to the temple, if you're not a worthy priesthood holder, then do you wait until you die to make those spiritual progressions? I believe that the work is being done or had been done. That's too large an issue for me as a small guy to deal with. And I'm not being ignorant of the issue. I'm saying, how do I change that one? Do I go and pound the rain? Do I go out and have a box with it? It's a disturbing issue. I believe we're all imperfect as members of this church, and that includes the hierarchy. I accept my leadership, and I ponder and pray all of the things that are given to me as revelation, and I can't comment on it much more than that, other than I have to seek it out in my own mind.
It probably would have been an issue for me growing up in Southern California and growing up in a racially diverse area, having many friends of Hispanic, African American, Asian American people that I grew up with, and seeing them as just friends and not really seeing beyond that. And I think having a mother that really pushed that there was no difference between any of us. She growing up in the projects in East Los Angeles, I think, growing up amongst those, you know, amongst the diversity also, I think it would have been an issue with me because I can't see anyone being taken out from whatever they want to be or want to do based on a color or a race. That would have been an issue.
It was a big issue for my mother. I was still her child, and she was still going to protect me, and she was very concerned not only about the way the LDS Church treated African Americans, but she was also concerned about the way they treated women. My mom was concerned that I was going to be joining a sexist organization and in the process become a little sexist myself. So it wasn't personally a problem for me, but it was a part of my conversion. It was something that I had to deal with. And I don't know how well I dealt with it, and I probably still try to deal with it. But that was my situation. As to the second part of your question, is there something like that that could really be a stumbling block for me? As a convert to the church, I think, and my process of joining the church was so full of controversial material, I don't think there's any one thing that could bring me down. I think there are some things that go on in the church today that bother me, and that I would like to see changed, but I don't think anything will shake my faith because I've already dealt with really weighty matters, I think, in my conversion. How much time, Frank?
2 minutes.
Nope. Well, that's about it. If we have one more.
I moved here already a Mormon, and it seems that we all relate to the Mormon community as a large community here in Utah, and are often lumped in a stereotype of sort of a drone-like mentality. Just things that are not pleasant references to the group. And I wonder if you have responses to that. Was there anything in your way of the perception of the community in its intensity in this valley? Or do you feel like you've lost any of your sharper edges and become more conforming? What would you say to other people, non-Mormons?
My quick answer, and I'll let everybody else answer, my quick answer is that initially I felt like I had to conform, and it's really only been since I came home from my mission that I felt like I can be my abrasive self.
I joined the church outside Utah, and Reiner and I specifically moved away from Salt Lake so that we could establish our family. I could investigate the church, and we left our parents here. I, to this day, am much more comfortable in the church outside of Utah. We're momentarily stuck here for a while again. And all I can say is that I'm used to being a minority, a religious minority, and I like that. I really like it. I like that. That keeps me with an edge. And what the only thing you need to do in Salt Lake, if you live in Salt Lake and you fear that you're going to, you know, just sort of meld into the crowd, is go get involved at the University of Utah. It's the most anti-Mormon place on earth. Okay, I love it.
The U, really? There's a problem there? Because of what I do for a living, I am consistently the token Mormon in nearly every circle I'm in, on a film set, in a theatrical rehearsal, commercials, wherever I am, primarily. And so I'm assumed that I'm not. And so I'm frequently subject to hearing Mormon bashing and expected to join in.